I shall call next on the bearded man in the cassock, standing near the back of the chapel. Yes, Father, would you like to ask a question? Question 4. Forgive me, Professor Kutzinger, but it seems you've been talking entirely around your main topic, Jesus and the world's religions. It's clear enough now that you don't think all the religions are true, but you obviously do think at least some of them are, and that non-Christians can be saved by their means. Perhaps the word salvation has a less profound meaning for you than it does for me. Maybe when you offer us the example of someone like this man, Martin Lings, it's just his apparent moral rectitude or something equally elementary that you've got in mind. But if it's anything more than that, I think in all fairness to your audience, you really must go back to the text first cited by your first interlocutor, John 14:6. And you need to explain to us, if you can, how you as a Christian can say that a Muslim who obviously doesn't believe in Jesus Christ can still be saved if, as Christ himself told us, no one comes to the Father except by me. Answer 4. Thank you for reminding us of this important passage of Scripture. It's often cited by Christians who believe theirs is the only true and saving faith. Before commenting on the verse itself, however, just a word or two as to what I mean by salvation. I'll be very surprised if it isn't what you yourself mean, since we're both Orthodox Christians. At the same time, I'll be equally surprised if it's not something rather different from what many of our Protestant and Catholic brethren here tonight have in mind when they use the word. You suspect me of not going far enough in my usage. They may well accuse me of having gone too far. The meaning I attach to the term was already hinted at in my last response. I pointed out that one of the criteria of a true and saving religion is that it must give its adherents the means of overcoming or extinguishing their egos so as to become participants in the very nature of God. In using that phrase, I was, of course, quoting a New Testament text, often used in defending our Orthodox doctrine of theosis or deification, namely 2 Peter 1:4. As to what this participation involves, I often refer my students, and would refer my audience now, to the provocative words of Gregory Palamas, a 14th century Orthodox theologian and saint. According to Palamas, the effects of salvation, which may begin to manifest themselves even now in this life, consist in our entering into a mode of existence that is, quote, without origin, indescribable, and supratemporal. With the result, he adds a fine paradox, that we creatures become uncreated. In other words, while remaining essentially human, we come to share in the defining powers and privileges of God himself, the uncreated creator. Even as Jesus, while retaining his essence as God, came to share in all the characteristics and properties that define us as human beings. Even as God shed human tears, bled human blood, and died a human death on the cross, so are we humans enabled to see with divine eyes, work with divine hands, and take up no space with a truly divine omnipresence, as does the one who was speaking to that stupefied dude Nicodemus. That's what I mean by salvation. And though I realize it must seem to you incredible, it's what I saw evidence of in my friend, Dr. Lings. I don't mean to suggest he was necessarily perfect or had yet become deified. But your phrase, moral rectitude, is simply not sufficient to account for what one sensed in his presence. On the contrary, it was clear to me, as to many others, not merely that this man didn't sin in his actions, but that his innermost thoughts and intentions had been correspondingly purified. To the point, in fact, that at the very end of his long life, he experienced what those who were close to him could only describe as a kind of clairvoyant or precognitive illumination regarding the precise moment he was going to die, a moment that found him in his zawiya, or oratory, with his tasbih, or prayer beads, in his hand, having just put the final touches to his last book, appropriately entitled A Return to the Spirit. Call it what you will, something very big and very good was clearly underway in this remarkable Muslim soul. Well, obviously a great deal more could be said about that, but I see other hands and I haven't even gotten to the main issue you raised. Like my first inquirer, you want to know how I can possibly think other religions can save, perhaps especially in the exalted sense I've described, if indeed Jesus Christ is the way, not a way, the truth, not a truth, and the life, not just a life. Let me cut straight to the heart of this matter by asking a question of my own. Namely, who's doing the talking in John 14:6 anyway? Who precisely is the I who am the way, the truth, and the life? And who's the me through whom one approaches the Father? According to the ancient teachings of the ecumenical councils, as you yourself know very well, the central I-ness of Christ, that is, the subject who thinks his thoughts, speaks his words, and is the agent of all his actions, is the eternal Word or Son of God, second person of the Holy Trinity. Jesus, in other words, isn't a man who was adopted by God, nor a man in whom God was the indwelling presence, nor an intermediate being created by God as the highest of creatures, nor again was he simply a composite being, part divine and part human. As I said in response to the first question tonight, who Jesus is the divine Son of God, by whom all things were made, as the Nicene Creed puts it. The Gospel of John is most emphatic in this regard. For the same person who says, I am the way, the truth, and the life, no one comes to the Father but by me, also says, before Abraham was, I am. I'd encourage everyone here to spend some time pondering the tenses of that passage. The bewildering juxtaposition of the past and the present, of the was and the am, clearly undercuts every effort, however well-intentioned, to identify Jesus with a strictly temporal set of saving facts. It's therefore a major mistake to confuse the uniqueness of the only begotten and eternal Son of God with the supposed singularity of his historical manifestation in first century Palestine. I've certainly no wish to deny that there's only one Son of God, or that he alone is the author of salvation, or that Jesus Christ is that Son. But I would insist very strongly there are no biblical or dogmatic grounds for supposing that this one Son has limited his saving work to his incarnate presence as Jesus. On the contrary, as St. Athanasius and other early theologians maintained, though the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, he was by no means confined to that flesh even during his earthly ministry. Once this subtle point has been grasped, a number of other scriptural teachings begin to take on a richer and more encompassing meaning. We're able to read in a new and fresh way that Jesus is the true light who enlightens every man that comes into the world, John 1:9, and that he has other sheep who are not of this fold, John 10:16. And we realize that the events of his passion on Golgotha were the working out at a particular time and place of a strictly timeless salvation. For the Lamb of God, whose act of righteousness leads to acquittal and life for all men, Romans 5:18, is slain from before the foundation of the world, Revelation 13:8. If we're willing to follow the thread of such clues, we begin to sense that the Son, or Word of God, far from being limited to a single religion, is the divine principle behind all revelation and the eternal source of salvation in every authentic or orthodox religion. Though truly incarnate as Jesus Christ in Christianity, there's no reason to think he's not savingly operative in and through other traditions as well. In some, he may be present in an equally personal way, as in Krishna and the other Hindu avatars, while in others he may appear in an impersonal way, as in the Quran of Islam, where he made himself book. Well, that was a long-winded and somewhat technical answer, I realize. But these issues are so very important and so close to the heart of my presentation tonight, I felt some elaboration was in order. Anyway, seems to me time for another question, and I'd like to call again on a student. Let's come back up front, where I see another scowling young person sitting at the opposite end of the row from my first interlocutor. You seem to be clutching rather tightly to that book in your lap, young lady. Could you show me what it is? Oh, yes, I see. She has a brand new copy of Richard Dawkins' recent salvo, The God Delusion. Did you have something you wanted to ask? Question 5. I really have to hand it to you, Kutzinger. So far, at least, you've stage-managed this evening quite cleverly. First, it's this fundamentalist guy. Then another hired hand like you who gets paid for professing this whole religion thing. Then that weird New Age junkie with the bizarre hairdo. And now, last but not least, we hear from this Christian priest in the cute black dress. Sorry. You get all these seemingly different people to throw you a bunch of softball questions, and then you put on this act like you're disagreeing with them or something. But truth is, they've all played right into your hands. None of them has the guts to ask the really tough questions, because each of their own pathetic little lives depends on helping you maintain the illusion. You did have to admit, I noticed, that there are at least a few intelligent people out there who think it's all just absurd, who look at religion, let's see, I wrote this down, yeah, here it is, as a historical curiosity or as a language game or as primitive superstition. But you never said why that's so bad. You just assumed everybody here would come along on your little parade, and I'm sure most of them have. I doubt they've read a word of Dawkins or Daniel Dennett or Sam Harris, and I doubt you have either. Anyway, you haven't even come close to discussing what anybody in their right mind can see as the bottom line issue here. You've given the intelligent atheist no reason at all to think there's a God in the first place, and certainly no reason for thinking that this great cosmic entity is somehow responsible for the confusing and obviously contradictory belief systems you want us all to honor. I don't need all your rhetoric about religions as launching pads and believers as astronauts. If you expect serious, scientific people to take you seriously, you need to give them some evidence. Show us this God of yours. Prove it's all not just a bunch of wishful thinking. Religion's history, Kutzinger, and you and the rest of the deluded masses need to face up to that fact. Answer 5. In responding to the opening question tonight, I began by pointing out that it actually included a trinity of related issues all rolled into one. And unless I'm mistaken, that's true as well of the challenge you've posed. Your 3 questions might be expressed in a more or less rhetorical form, though unlike you, I'm far from thinking them rhetorical questions. First, isn't it obvious that faith is just wishful thinking, something weak or childish people use to cope with a world that's too harsh to bear? Second, isn't it true there's no evidence for the claims of religion? And third, doesn't it follow that atheism is the more intelligent position than theism? Let me assure you, I can understand where you're coming from. And frankly, I admire your chutzpah in speaking out as you have, though your question is a bit of a tangent to my main theme tonight. In an academic climate, however, that is in many quarters growing less and less hospitable to religious conviction, it's inevitable that thoughtful people, including believers themselves, would be asking such questions. Obviously, a book could be written in answer to each. About all I can do here tonight is provide just a hint, just the briefest of intimations, really, as to where I might start were I authoring these 3 books. My answers, in any case, as you probably expected, are no, no, and no. First of all, no. It's not obvious that faith is just wishful thinking, or at least it's not obvious it's necessarily so. I add that qualification because I agree that certain forms or levels of belief can be rather childish, as is the faith of the grown-up who still thinks God has a beard, or sits on a throne, or exists for the sole purpose of dispensing chocolate. But there's also such a thing as childish disbelief. In my experience, many atheists haven't been given all the chocolate they want, and are therefore mad at God for not existing. William James's distinction between the tough and tender-minded applies to both theists and atheists. In both groups, we find people whose perspective on life is based on what they regard as objective facts and good reasons. Those are the tough-minded in James's terms. As well as other people whose perspectives is based on purely subjective desires. And those are the tender-minded. In any case, it's important to realize that the sophistical dismissiveness skeptics often employ in debate, which takes the form of saying, oh, you just think that because you're immature, or uneducated, or depressed, or had a dysfunctional family, or are subject to some sort of chemical imbalance, is a game two can play. Perhaps the atheist is just afraid of commitment or responsibility or being thought a fool by his friends. According to Freud, you know, religion is really just repressed sexuality. But there's nothing to stop us from countering that sexuality is really just repressed religion. No, again, it isn't true. There's no evidence for the claims of religion. The crucial word here, of course, is evidence. I'm pretty sure when you use the term, you're thinking exclusively of empirical evidence, and thus buying into the assumptions I was critiquing earlier in responding to my first 2 interlocutors. Like many people on today's college campuses, you're assuming the only things we can truly know are things we have some sort of physical evidence for, or for which we might apply for some grant money. Things we can see, hear, taste, touch, or smell, either directly through one or more of these 5 natural senses or indirectly through the mediation of an instrument like a microscope that's been designed to magnify or amplify the reach of those senses. What I'm not sure you've noticed, however, is the statement, the only things we can truly know are things we have some sort of physical evidence for, is not something there is or could be any physical evidence for. The claim of the empiricist or positivist is therefore just as metaphysical as the claims of the world's religions, which he means to deprecate. For he asserts a truth, or in this case a falsehood, about the way things ultimately are, and he does so in a way presupposing some non-empirical or supersensible intuition or insight. Finally, no. Atheism is not the more intelligent position. On the contrary, atheism is self-contradictory. Think about it. The atheist says there is no God. Now, anyone who says there is no blank is giving voice to what a logician would call a universal negative proposition, whatever you place in the blank. It's negative because it says no and denies something, and it's universal because the field it encompasses is unlimited. If I said, there is no platypus in this chapel, I would also be uttering a negative statement. But it wouldn't be universal because the context would be restricted to this building, and we could verify or disconfirm the truth of my statement by arming everyone in the room with a flashlight, fanning out throughout the building, and engaging in a systematic platypus hunting exercise. Notice, however, that when atheists say there is no God, they're not saying there's no God in this chapel, or there's no God in Greenville, or there's no God in our galaxy. They're saying there is no God anywhere in the entire universe, no God at all, wherever one might look throughout the full extent of reality. Their statement's universal. But in doing so, they're implying that they've done the looking. They've carefully inspected all the nooks and crannies of existence, even as we'd need to inspect all the nooks and crannies of this building to know there's no platypus in it. If, however, they've truly looked everywhere there is to look, if they can honestly say they're personally acquainted with the full extent of reality, it follows that they must be omniscient. But omniscience is an attribute of God. Therefore, in saying there is no God, atheists are implicitly claiming to be God and thus inevitably contradicting themselves. If you don't mind, I'd like to ask you a couple questions before moving on. Just nod or shake your head. In my lecture, I referred to a number of key authorities on what we might call the technology of the spiritual life. And I'm wondering whether you'd ever heard of them. How about Patanjali? No, I didn't think so. Nicephorus the Solitary? No again. Maybe Jalaluddin Rumi? Ah, you're cautiously nodding on this one. So I guess the name rings a bell, probably because of the popularity of his poetry. But have you actually studied his teachings? No. Well, let me ask you this. Have you ever tried to concentrate on only one thought? And have you noticed that it's almost impossible to do so for more than 3 or 4 seconds? Yes, good. So that's a familiar experience. You're familiar with the fact that your ordinary day-to-day consciousness is highly undisciplined, in fact, almost completely out of control. Here's my point. Each of the three sages I mentioned, the first Patanjali was the most renowned of all Hindu teachers of yoga. The second, Nicephorus the Solitary, was a hesychast master of the Christian East. And the third, Jalaluddin Rumi, was a great Sufi sheikh. Each of them taught his students a method for gaining control of their consciousness, for bringing it into a state of stillness or stability that could in turn serve as a portal, I'm tempted to say as a launching pad, to levels, modalities, or dimensions of consciousness ordinarily hidden or dormant, dimensions through which and in which they might come to experience directly the ultimate source of all things. You want to have evidence? You want somebody to show you God, you said? Very well. These and other great masters, both past and present, are fully prepared to assist. But they're going to require what any serious scientific person like yourself already knows is essential when testing some theory. Namely, that she enter into the laboratory, which is in this case her mind, carefully following the procedures, making use of the equipment these spiritual scientists have given her. Until you've done that, I'm sorry to say, it's just a sign of sheer ignorance to think the claims of the world's religions are not verifiable. An ignorance, let me add at once, which is far more understandable and forgivable in someone your age than in the compilers of writing protocols for university websites. Well, I think we'd better start wrapping things up. There should be time for one final question. And I'm going to give that opportunity once more to a fellow professor. Yes, please. The gentleman with the graying hair and trimly cut mustache. Question 6. Thank you very much for your comments this evening. I believe I have a somewhat clearer picture of your position than I did before. I confess I'm still not quite certain, however, what or whether the perspective you've described contributes to discussions of religious pluralism. I'm fairly sure you don't think the concept of a transcendent unity of religions simply dissolves the issue of pluralism by reducing concrete traditions to a common core. But I wonder whether you might say a bit more about that. Also, I'd appreciate some further reflections on the subject of epistemology, the theory of knowledge. I share your concerns about scientism and would like, as you would, to find a post-critical way of affirming those aspects of human experience that are of a more personal and tacit character. I believe we often know more than we can clearly articulate in the terms and categories favored by the scientific enterprise. And I sense this may be what you have in mind when you speak about the importance of the vertical. Occasionally, though, your language suggests something more, especially when you allude to the mystics. Sometimes you seem to be saying, we can escape the force of gravity altogether, if I might borrow your rocket metaphor, that we can transcend, that's the word you've been stressing, the shaping forces of our cultures and histories, and perhaps even the limits of embodied existence. And I confess, I'm finding it a bit more difficult to agree with you there. Answer 6. I'm delighted you've asked this, for linking the two parts of your query may be of some help in pulling together this evening's discussion. You've posed two distinct questions, but the very fact that you've paired them suggests they're rather closely connected, as indeed they are. In fact, the metaphysical issue of whether there really is such a thing as a transcendent unity of religions, and if so, what this might entail, and the epistemological issue of how far human knowledge extends or might extend are really two sides of a single coin. Which is why, though the subject of my lecture was Jesus and the world's religions, I've spent so much time in this follow-up session, it may seem to some a disproportionate amount of time, lampooning the flatlander approach to religion and lambasting our professional colleagues for the arbitrary restrictions so many of them wish to place on our powers of knowing. To turn to the first part of your question, I suppose it all depends on what is meant by a couple of key terms. I confess I'm always a little bit uncomfortable when I hear the word pluralism. If it simply means that one acknowledges a plurality of saving traditions, then of course there's no problem for me. My sense, however, is that in many academic contexts today, the word has a relativistic or perspectivalistic connotation, which I would certainly want to avoid. For, as I hope my lecture made clear, I don't believe the orthodox religions of the world are simply the results of man's efforts to make sense of his universe on his own or from the bottom up. My position, instead, is that each is a top-down and thus divine revelation. As for reducing these revelations to a common core, the phrase suggests one is searching for some sort of ethical or doctrinal least common denominator, and that's certainly not my aim. It is, of course, possible to distill any number of moral constants from the great world religions. My friend Peter Kraft, a Boston College philosophy professor who spoke here at Furman, I believe, some years ago, has a very fine article entitled Ecumenical Jihad, in which he envisions an alliance of religious believers from different traditions against what he takes to be their common enemy, namely a globally increasing materialism or scientism or secularism. I agree with Kraft that a collaboration of this kind, based on an underlying ethical unanimity or commonality, is certainly possible, and indeed desirable. But that's not what I'm speaking of here. Nor am I speaking, or not at least in the main, about a convergence of dogmas or worldviews. That there is such a convergence, I very firmly believe. That doesn't mean we should ignore the doctrinal disparities, even contradictions, which certainly do exist between specific religions, or as you've called them, concrete traditions. But I can think of no case where such disparities can't be resolved through prayerful study of the intentions behind the doctrines. Resolution, however, is not reduction, but rather an extrapolation, if you will, or better perhaps, a sort of spiritual intussusception, to use a word one doesn't get to use very often. It's what happens when you stick your hand down your sock, take a hold of the toe, and pull it back inside out, intussusception. Hindu polytheism, Buddhist atheism, so-called, and Jewish monotheism can then be seen as so many pointers or points of entry, leading us in the direction of a single reality that ultimately exceeds all our words, revealed or otherwise. So now, the transcendent unity of religions, and now I'm segueing to the other half of your question, is a unity I understand to be manifest not so much at the moral or even doctrinal level, but in the deifying experiences of the world's greatest sages and saints. I've mentioned a few such figures already in this Q&A session. I could add to that list the names of the Hindu Shankara, the Buddhist Nagarjuna, the Christian Eckhart, and the Muslim Ibn al-Arabi, each of whom ascended to the very pinnacle of their respective paths, and thus to the highest of all states of knowledge, where knower and known are but a single, indivisible self. So you see, you're very right to have picked up on my allusions to the mystics, and you're very right as well to have sensed that I have in mind something quite extraordinary when I speak of the vertical. I hope you and the rest of my audience can also begin to appreciate why I therefore gave this un-lecture a deliberately Zen-sounding title. Why I prefaced my remarks with a distinction between the human atmosphere and the divine stratosphere. Why I paused to congratulate Nicodemus for the stupefaction he felt in talking to someone whose isness overcomes every wasness. Why, I've more than once hinted that the time and space-defying operations of this flummoxing someone should be taken as models, as well as causes, of our own liberation. And why I've been at such pains to accentuate the full meaning of salvation as a deifying participation in the very nature of God. Though I myself am no saint, and am very far from fully understanding the spiritual mechanics of these emptying, transforming, and deifying operations, even among those woolly fellows who share my own fold, let alone among sheep whose enclosures are elsewhere, I'm nonetheless certain that the flummoxing someone in question, whom, like my fellows, I call Jesus Christ, must be at work there too. As I've already mentioned, one important source of this certitude is that I've personally had the great blessing of meeting a few rare individuals from other religious traditions, in whom one could discern the marks of transcendence. Such exemplary people have convinced me that the biographies of great saints from the past are to be regarded not as pious exaggerations, but as provocations or invitations, pointing us all in the direction of what we might truly become. I've also been convinced, of course, by my scholarly research, as should be obvious from the references I've scattered throughout these remarks. Research focused for many years on the teachings of spiritual masters from a wide range of traditions, gurus, murshids, Roshis, Garons, to use just a few of their technical titles. And from your point of view, as my audience, this is clearly the more important basis for the convictions I've been sharing tonight, since judging its value doesn't depend on your trusting what is, after all, the purely anecdotal testimony of your speaker about the people he's met. On the contrary, you too can share in the intellectual explorations that have led to my certitude concerning the existence of multiple paths up the mountain. For those who might be intrigued by this prospect, I shall close by assigning some homework. I recommend very strongly that you spend some time slowly reading and ruminating over a truly remarkable anthology of spiritual writings called A Treasury of Traditional Wisdom, compiled by a man named Whitall Perry. This is a book that brings together selections from each of the world's sacred scriptures, as well as from the writings of numerous saints and sages, both East and West. And it does so in such a way as to demonstrate, beyond every shadow of a doubt, I would say, the inward and transcendent unity of their outward and horizontal differences. Make no mistake, the value of this anthology, however, is more than just theoretical. It's a book that can also be of tremendous practical use to the person who wishes to begin testing the methods prescribed by the likes of Patanjali, Nicephorus, and Rumi. Here's the Furman Library copy, passed to me secretly by a spy of mine who works there. It was purchased 2 years ago at my spy's request, and since then I'm very disappointed to tell you it's not been taken off the shelf until today. But it will be back in the library tomorrow morning, ready for all you truly serious scientific people to make use of in your laboratories. If you really want to have evidence, if you want someone to show you God, first of all in his several disguises, and then, eventually, face to face, that, in my opinion, is an excellent place to get started. Well, I'm not sure we're quite out of questions yet, but I believe I am out of time. I thank you for your kind attention.